I'm Gemma Craddock and this is Playback Daily for Thursday the 25th of March. And from UFOs to trash talk to dance cures, we had it all on Radio 1 today.
Imagine all of the problems that you've got, the anxieties you've got, the ruminating about the future, worrying about, you know, whether something will happen.
Have you been talking to my wife?
Well, it's brilliant because when you dance, if you dance with your wife, then some of those problem-solving things become clearer.
Now, what springs to mind when you think of Boris Johnson? This story. Human penises are shrinking because of pollution.
Everybody says, oh, aren't we living in a terrible world? I don't believe that. We are living with a terrible evil.
And I'd be fairly strong in speaking up about things. I wonder how other people are doing. It feels like you're in a war zone. It feels like you're down in the bunker and you're literally just going shot by shot. You're a bit of news do I have to deal with now?
Let's start things with a bit of an oomph, thanks to Dr. Dance. On the Ray Darcy Show, we met Dr. Peter Lovett. But how did he get his nickname?
I was a professional dancer first. I was rubbish at school. And dancing helped me overcome a reading difficulty in my early 20s. And then I discovered psychology. I discovered reading and psychology. I did degrees in psychology and then neural computation, so the mathematical modelling of brain functions. I then did my PhD. And then when I was at Cambridge University, I decided to set up a dance psychology lab to use all of my science to look at dancing.
Yes.
And then when I did that, I started off by looking at people with Parkinson's disease. And what we found is that when people with Parkinson's, now this is a neurodegenerative disorder, when people with Parkinson's dance, it leads to an improvement in their medical symptoms, which is really rather extraordinary. So that's where the research into dance really started.
Okay, we'll come back to Parkinson's in a moment, but what's the evolutionary value of dancing, Peter?
Oh, dancing is fantastic. There is no society anywhere in the world where the people don't dance naturally.
Right.
Little tiny babies groove. Now, we know that when people dance together, it bonds societies together. It bonds people together. There's a brilliant study which found that when people move together in time, they afterwards, even complete strangers, report liking each other more, they trust each other more, they feel more psychologically similar, and they show more helpful behaviour towards each other, even little tiny children and adults. So dancing bonds societies together. It's fantastic.
Have you seen this? Jerusalemma. Have you seen the dances all over the world, people doing this dance?
Oh, no, I haven't.
Oh, it's amazing. Put in Jerusalemma into Google when you're finished with us.
Yeah,
It started somewhere in Angola or someplace in Africa.
Yeah.
And it came to our attention recently because our police force on Garda Síochána, they started doing it because the Swiss police force threw down the gauntlet and asked them to do it. They've done it in New York, they've done it in Canada. And groups all over the world have got together and danced together to this tune.
It's fantastic.
It's a sort of a funky line dance routine that people can learn very easily. And schools are doing it and frontline workers are doing it. And it's just... And it's the perfect song as well. I'll play a bit for you. So there's definitely a social element to it. We know that.
There really is.
What happens in the brain then when we're dancing?
Oh, all kinds of things happen in the brain. So, we know, for instance, that people's pain thresholds go up when they dance. So when you dance, it can release opioids in the brain, and that can do all kinds of amazing things. We know that it makes us happy, so we know we're triggering some happy areas of the brain, but we know also these opioid receptors become more active, and that means that people's pain thresholds go up.
Nice.
Now, of course, this is fantastic in all kinds of ways, not just for dancing at 3 a.m. in a pair of stilettos, which must be very painful, but also when you're carrying all kinds of pain in your body, then dancing can help relieve some of that pain.
Right. And it's obviously it's a physical exercise, so that's good. You're getting that part of it in. And then it cheers you up. So there's a dopamine release, but what else is going on?
Oh, well, the cheering up is fantastic. What we know is that when you look at people's moods and emotions after they dance, even if you just get them boogieing for a couple of minutes to a funky tune or any pop tune, and then afterwards their positive mood states go up. So there's an improvement in those happy moods and positive moods, but there's also a decrease in negative moods. So things like anxiety, frustration, fatigue, anger, those emotional states become lower. Now, what's brilliant about that is there's a relationship between people's moods and people's problem-solving abilities. And what some research has found, or what we found and other people have found, is that when you improve people's moods through dancing, then their problem-solving becomes more highly tuned. Now, this is great. Imagine all of the problems that you've got, the anxieties you've got, the ruminating about the future, worrying about, you know, whether something will happen.
Have you been talking to my wife?
Well, it's brilliant, because when you dance, if you dance with your wife, then some of those problem-solving things become clearer.
Yeah.
We find it easier to solve problems. We get more complex solutions to those problems.
Okay, and why we have you on this week is because we spotted an article in the Daily Mail. You have a book out called The Dance Cure, and you're offering people advice during lockdown because you feel that dance can reignite intimacy in relationships that maybe have got a bit of a knocking because of the pandemic.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things the pandemic has done is brought us together. So my wife and I, for instance, I used to be travelling all over the place and we didn't spend much time together in the house because I was always travelling.
Mm.
The lockdown happened and now we've spent virtually an entire year in the same building, which we've almost never done before. Now, of course, that can lead to all kinds of tensions. And while people are together, they then become distant from one another. They start orbiting, you know, moving in different orbits in the same place. And it can lead to frustrations, it can affect intimacy, it can affect all kinds of things. And what we've done, we're using dance to help people come together. So looking at people completely, so looking at the social element, looking at their thinking, looking at their emotions, and looking at them physically, we are able to use dance to help people come together. And we can either improve things like intimacy, frustration, love, a whole range of things we can help people with dancing.
So your advice to people listening today is dance. That's pretty straightforward. But do you start with a fast dance? We used to have this thing in Ireland. I don't know if you had them in England back in nightclubs and discos back in the day. We'd have a slow set. You had them, yeah. So they'd be dancing away and next thing the DJ go, and now it's time for a slow set.
Yeah, but you see, the DJ had built up to that all night,
and so had you.
That's what we need to do now. So we need to help people find their groove.
Yes.
So you can find your groove all by yourself. That's absolutely great.
So I'll put something on here. Here we go, yeah.
Okay.
So find your groove to something. Okay, here we go. You're finding your groove now. Okay, here we go.
Now, this is brilliant.
Go on, talk us through it.
Okay, so now this song is fantastic because it's got a bit of syncopation in there. And the sensory motor coupling area of the brain is taking this music and it's creating movement throughout your body, or an urge to move to your body. And that's your groove. Once you've... Oh, did you hear that?
Yes.
Now, so lovely. Because once you find your groove together, then you can start finding a groove with another person.
Uh-huh.
Now, you and I, Ray, we could both be dancing to this piece of music.
Yeah.
And we're almost, even though we're in different places, we can synchronize together while we're doing it. Now, imagine doing that, finding that groove. And then you can find the groove with another person.
Yes.
And start to move with them.
Uh-huh.
And then let's imagine your relationship is characterized by frustration and a bit of anger and short-temperedness.
Yes.
Obviously, what you need to bring in is some fun and engagement and enjoyment. And sometimes we can use dance to help people find that joy. We can get people smiling again and making eye contact with each other, as you would in a nightclub or a disco.
And then before you know it, Peter.
Now there we are. That's the one. That's the one. And then, of course, when you get to that stage, you can start feeling each other's grooves.
Yes.
And you can get into each other and move together. And then that's when the magic happens.
Okay. Now, for people who are listening and going, I can't dance, I've two left feet, never able to dance, just can't do it. It's embarrassing.
No, there's no such thing as you can't dance. Everybody, humans are born to dance. It's like saying you can't be a human. You are a human. If you're a human, you can dance. Everybody, regardless of your perceived abilities, what sort of limbs you've got, you can dance. Everybody can. Once we take away the judgment and the self-consciousness, then we get that natural groove coming through us. And it's as natural as breathing. I mean, literally, humans are born to dance.
Dance, okay.
So there you have it. Dr. Peter Lovett, author of The Dance Cure on The Ray D'Arcy Show. So get dancing, but not for about 50 minutes, please. Early in the day, Oliver Callan, still covering duties for Mr. T, gave us our daily digest of news stories that caught his eye.
Now, sad results of the match last night, which I kind of enjoyed. And I really enjoy when there's no fake crowd noises pumped in, because you experience it the same way as the players. The rugby one is a little jarring because you see the the players, you're kind of wondering, how come they're not reacting to the crowd? Oh yeah, because only we're hearing. Yeah, anyway. A sad result, but strangely one full of hope, because there was zero anticipation or even build-up. He barely knew the thing was about to happen. But anyway, we're a little bit hopeful now, because there has been a goal after a long time, and feeling good for Stephen Kenny, who feels like the unluckiest banished door. Let's ask the biggest footy fan in the country, President Higgins.
Yes, yes, indeed. It was a night in Belgrade. Even though we've all been locked up for a year, you wouldn't envy that city break now, would you, infer? But wonderful soccer players. Serbia, not an easy team. I didn't know the words, but their national anthem does sound like someone doing terrible things to someone else. Very, very strong players, of course. Lukic, Mitrovic, Pilinic. Ireland's qualifiers now. They're a bit like Joe Biden trying to board a plane. You mustn't run too fast, you see. You'll fall over once, look totally ridiculous, fall a second time and we're bleeding scarlet for you. And then the third time, you know, we're laughing, crying face emoji. But, you know, to take it easy, Stephen Kinney, hold the metaphorical handrail and don't make a total badger's banjo of the whole thing. Might I add also that my dogs are much better behaved than Uchtharon Biden's. Berbua, berbua.
Thank you very much, President Michael D. Higgins. Yes, he's right, because in the Journal today, Joe Biden's dogs, naughty dogs, are back in the news, because you might remember one of the canines injured a Secret Service agent and they were sent to Delaware. It sounds like a metaphor, doesn't it? Being sent to Coventry, you know, when you're silenced. But no, quite literally sent to Delaware for training. Joe Biden's dogs, Champ and Major. Major was the younger dog, is a rescue dog. Injured the Secret Service agent. But White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said at yesterday's briefing, the dog met the Bidens last weekend at Camp David. Getting around, isn't this dog? It's getting around. He then came back to Washington on Sunday. So all is well there with Major. And I love the fact that we're just discussing Joe Biden's dog and nothing else in America. That's the main thing. Actually, on the match last night, there's a lot of love around for Seamus Coleman because in the pre-match build-up press conference, he was saying very nice things. He was defending the performances of Shane Duffy. And basically, he's reached peak soundness, hasn't he? So, you know, if they just let Seamus Coleman do the Neffet briefings, then people might actually like what they're hearing. It's just an idea. Just an idea. I'll throw it out there. Anyway, we have Luxembourg on Saturday, don't we? And then we've got Portugal in September. Eek. Eek. Whew. But it's to qualify for the Qatar World Cup. I mean, would you want those nice fellas to end up in a World Cup in a desert in the height of summer in Qatar? Because I think literally thousands of people have died, haven't they? Workers, migrant workers in the construction. Now, I never thought we'd be discussing the Suez Canal, but this is the 2020s. So everything you thought that was easy is now just suddenly pants. And never let that thing be said about women drivers, by the way, because this was a lad with an L plate wedging the ship full of fast fashion, and I presume, because we were discussing that yesterday, and all the other stuff you're ordering online and you'll throw out within an hour of getting it from the nice DPD man. Anyway, they blocked one of the busiest shipping routes in the world, because everyone now is an expert on the Suez Canal between that episode of The Crown and by laughing about it on social media. Carl Kinsella on social media, his journalist, said, we're about 5 minutes away from Stephen Donnelly announcing that all of our vaccines were being stored in the big ship stuck in the Suez Canal for some reason. Also, apropos, related to the match, he also tweeted separately that Stephen Kenny has the most Irish haircut I've ever seen. I think it's a very Dublin haircut, actually. I'd go further than that, Carl. And I do suspect some people are kind of almost on purpose doing that kind of a really bad haircut to prove, look, I didn't do a black market haircut. I'm staying the course. And there are some people who are just refusing to get the hair, let it grow. And look, it's my sacrifice. But anyway, by the way, that ship is still there. 24 hours later, BBC News says dozens of vessels are stuck waiting for rescue boats to free the 400 metre long ship. People are going overboard to describe how... Oh, that's a shipping cliche. God. To describe the length of it, I saw four football fields. Someone said it was like a skyscraper lying on its side. Anyway, the ship was knocked off course by strong winds, and Egypt had to reopen an older canal to divert traffic so that it can move again. The blockage even sent oil prices climbing on international markets. Imagine being the captain of that. And it was all the wind that did it. Or leaves on the track, probably. Now, very important. Food is obviously vital for us at the moment. Thankfully, you're not waiting on it to come through the Suez Canal. But the humble breakfast roll, according to the Irish Examiner today, was the most ordered item through Deliveroo this year in Cork. Oh yeah, just in Cork. So in the past year, many of us have swapped visiting restaurants with trying new takeaways, and the range of tastes across the country surprisingly varied. So new statistics released by Deliveroo show the top dishes ordered by Irish people, and the regional variations are really, they actually are interesting. So burritos and burgers are the top two choices nationally via Deliveroo. But in Cork, they don't like the foreign delicacies, you know. They like the humble, homegrown hero. And that is the beloved breakfast roll. So they order, you ring up and you order a breakfast roll from Deliveroo. Does that work? That's going to be a bit soggy when it gets there, won't it? The most ordered dish in Cork, a breakfast roll from Herlihy's Centra, with chicken choices from Roosters Piri Piri and Sober Lane, rounding out the top three orders down in Cork. So what happens there? Oh, by the way, further down the list, this will strike a chord now with lots of people down by the Lee. A battered sausage from Lennox's Chipper. Apparently it's a Cork legend. That was also very popular in the Rebel County. But what about the rest of the country? In Galway. So you know Galway, they have the notions, don't they? Because they're students and they all become cool and they learn how to play the Ilan pipes. Their most popular thing was a burrito bowl from Boojum. Oh. And then think of Limerick. And you're thinking, yeah, what'll be the... Because they love Chicken Hut down there, don't they? And Donkey Ford's. There's actually like a division in Limerick. The true division is whether you prefer Chicken Hut and Donkey Ford's. Well, the most popular thing in Limerick is a chicken gyoza from Kyoto Sushi and Noodle. Top of the list. Didn't see that coming, I have to say. But mind you, there you see, it's not appreciated how posh Limerick can be. There is a Limerick 4. There's a very, very serious poshness down there. They're with the rugby. And apparently people are also ordering booze on Deliveroo. Guinness is the most ordered alcoholic drink. Ben and Jerry's ice cream is the most ordered sweet treat. And there's a whole list there in the Irish Examiner. Burrito bowl from Boojum. They're Dublin, Cork, Galway and Limerick. Very fond of that myself now, I must say, because the kind of the wrap of the burrito is just too much. It's just too nappy-like. It's too heavy. I'm always peeling bits off. Just stick it in a bowl, get a fork. You don't need the thing. You know, it's like, I only realised this recently that I actually don't really like sandwiches. I just like the contents. I don't need, goodness, I'm going too far.
And on the topic of going too far.
somebody says, yes, Simon Harris is on TikTok. What a year, says this text message. Yes, this is actually true. I'm looking at it here. He only joined TikTok yesterday. His first video has, I'm not joking, he has 605,000 views. Simon Harris, 36,000 followers in a day. And he describes himself as government minister, Wicklow TD, optimist. Surprised he didn't include hashtag Greystones gangster, hashtag Bezzymates with a happy pair. Hello, everyone. It's great. Look at the wave in my hair. That's my wave that I'm riding all the way to the TikTok Taoiseach. Oh, I'm bald. Yes, he's just an influencer now, isn't he? Because politics is about personality. A lot of the time, I'd say that for the opposition as well, to be balanced about it. Big personalities there and big influencer stuff. You know, shinfluencers, you could call them as well. Anyways, Simon Harris is there. You can follow him on TikTok, which he spells T-I-C-T-I-K. T-I-C-T-O-K instead of T-I-K-T-O-C because social media spelling has just gone out the road. But he's there anyway. He's very, very, very important. And, I'd say there's some people in Fine Gael high up now. Fellas high up in Fine Gael getting very nervous with that fella on the way. Anyway, what am I talking about? Yes. God, this is... Well, I better read our text before I go to the next story. What we love up here in East Donegal and West Tyrone is a filled soda. It's a soda farl filled with Doherty's sausages. Absolutely lovely, says Sean in East Donegal, where pretty much, I think, 40% of the population are called Doherty. And the rest of them are called Gallagher. Wouldn't that be right? Gallagher. And I wonder, are you East Donegal? Now, I wouldn't know that accent because North Donegal is very clipped. Like, you know, they're very clipped up North Donegal. And South Donegal is where you'll find, you know, the people like John McTeer and Daniel.
And what a delight for Oliver when Bojo popped up in the news.
Now, yes, Boris Johnson says pub landlords, which basically that's what they, it's a very loaded term here, isn't it? But over there, a landlord is someone who just owns and runs a pub. He says that they could bar punters without vaccine certificates, if you're from certain parts of the country. Apparently, Sky tells us that Boris Johnson dropped a number of news bombs yesterday, but the biggest one was that the pub landlords may be given the power to bar anyone without a COVID jab in the future, and a massive blow to the nation's under 40s who will not get their vaccines until much later in the year. Asked about vaccine certificates for pubs, he said, I think that's the kind of thing that may be up to individual publicans. It may be up to the landlord, basically, yes. And at that EU-UK story about the vaccines, I don't know what's going on there. I don't think really, not even Tony Connolly can simplify it and make sense. Actually, somebody sent me a very good article, Cathy Sheridan, opinion piece, irishtimes.com, really good, breaks it all down and says it's all kind of nonsense because it's interconnected and there's the recipes are going everywhere. And even if the UK tried to blockade it, it would just speed things up and there would only be a week of a difference. So why can't we all just get along? And because of the gap, of course, this is interesting that the Brits aren't going to be way, way ahead of us because they have to, in terms of the two vaccines, because we're leaving less of a gap. Anyway, it makes sense. Don't listen to what I'm saying. Cathy Sheridan puts it all very simple. There's also a very nice analogy about a pigeon playing chess. Trust me, it's good. Now, what springs to mind when you're thinking of Boris Johnson? This story, human penises are shrinking because of pollution, warns a scientist. Now, it's a serious story. Penises are shrinking and genitals becoming malformed because of pollution, which an environmentalist scientist has warned in a new book detailing the challenges facing human reproduction. Dr. Shanna Swan writes that humanity is facing an existential crisis in fertility rates as a result of flatates. Oh no, hang on. What are flatulates? I could say it upstairs, but now that I'm on the radio, it's impossible. Anyway, that's a chemical that's used when manufacturing plastics that impacts the hormone-producing endocrine system, or endocrine. One study published in 2017 found that sperm levels among men in Western countries, that's us, sperm levels had dropped by more than 50% over the past four decades after examining 185 studies. Anyway, it's a downward trend, one direction only, on the declining sperm levels. And she believes, Dr. Swan, the rapidly decreasing fertility rate means that most men will be unable to produce viable sperm by 2045, which is, you know, that's pretty scary. This is actually something that Erin Brockovich, yes, that Erin Brockovich, was writing about last week. It's all about, she talks about pollution in the water and the problems with all these chemicals that are in plastic containers, food wrapping and fragrances and cleaning products, to soaps and shampoos, to electronics and carpeting. So it's kind of everywhere, and it's something that is very, you know, it's a challenge. It's a real thing.
Well, we'll leave that dangling there, in a manner of speaking. Oliver Callan on the Ryan Tuberty Show. And sure, while we're on the topic, let's look into the nitty-gritty of plastics and recycling. Knowing what waste goes where is a tricky topic. And joining Claire Byrne for a bit of trash talk was Mindy O'Brien from the environmental group Voice Ireland.
Listen, the first bit of rubbish I want to talk to you about, cups, keep cups, because since the pandemic started, we were all so good with our keep cups. Many of us were using our recyclable cups for coffee. That kind of went out the window. Is it back now? Are you allowed to use those cups, reusable ones again?
Yeah, it's funny because people thought they were banned. They really weren't. It's just a few of the coffee companies, their coffee shops, they weren't accepting them because of concerns about COVID. But actually, they're fine. And there's a new system that's been around in many countries, and it's been done here as well. It's called contactless coffee. So you can bring your own cup. You can put it on a tray. You push the tray over to the barista. They don't touch your cup. They put whatever you want, whether it's tea or latte or espresso, whatever, and then they push the tray back to you. You put your lid on and you go. And we're asking all cafes to adopt this process to kind of get the renewed use of reusables again.
Okay. And then, of course, I'm sure you've seen that there's extra waste since the pandemic began, the PPE, the masks, yeah, and so on around the place. We've all seen it with our own eyes.
Yeah, it's terrible, and I know they did a survey in the UK, and they estimated about 30% increase in plastic waste because of all the PPE, and we know we're all seeing it in along the beaches, on the roadways. You know, if people if they could just switch to reusables, reusable masks. And I don't think gloves really help you very much. So, you know, try to avoid the disposable ones if you can.
Okay. And then the last time you were on, I know you were talking about the different coloured bins. And there's some confusion. It's understandable around this because different coloured bins mean different things in different parts of the country, don't they?
Yeah, yeah, I know. I think people are saying, well, my recycling bin is blue. I think on the west side, west part of the country, it's blue. On the east coast, it's green. In the middle, it could be red. I mean, they're all different colors. I think it's because they privatized the waste companies, and each waste company wanted to appear a little bit different. And so we have so many different colors of the rainbow right now for our recycling bin. The government has recognized this, and they are in the process of creating a uniform color scheme. And so they are in the process of that. I believe they've agreed that the green will be the recycling bin, but it's going to take a while to get all the bins to that color.
Okay. Now, I know that you'd be aware that most people, myself included, you have something in your hand, you open the bin and you have that conversation with yourself. Which bin does it go in? And Katie is one of these people. She's texted us to say, on a Tetra milk carton, should I remove the plastic spout?
No, keep it in. But just you can crush it to save space, flatten it, put the lid back on, and it will. Because if you take the lids off, and this goes for anything, if you take the lids off, they're so small, they fall off the line. So if you can keep it in with the container. And interestingly, under the EU directive, plastic waste directive, single-use plastic directive, that in the future that the caps will be tethered to the bottles, like for Coke bottles and things like that.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
If I rinse tin foil, can I put that in the recycling?
Yes, if it's clean, just rinse it, you know, rinse it off, put it in a ball and put it into your recycling bin.
Okay, now we have so many texts coming in. The minute you start speaking, Mindy, you know this happens. Plastic flower pots, where do they go?
Yeah, I always thought that they belonged in the rubbish bin, but I think they now can go into your recycling bin. But try to reuse them if possible. I think you can. I've got loads of them, and I can wash them. But I think they can go into your recycling bin now.
The black plastic that meat comes in.
Yes. For a while, they were rejecting black plastics because the problem was the black plastic looks the same as the conveyor belt, so the optical scanners could not see it. So now I think they've put a different dye, and so now they can see it. So the black plastics, as long as they're clean, can go and dry, can go into your recycling bin.
And I mentioned there at the start the cans with widgets in. What happens to those?
Yeah, you can put those into the recycling bin. The widgets will fall out during the recycling process.
And then the old reliables, eggshells, they go into the brown, don't they, the compost?
Yes, they go into the compost. And if you have your own compost bin or compost pile in your garden, they can go in there as well.
The egg box goes in with them?
You have two options. If the egg breaks and so you have a yolk or whatever on the carton, put that into your compost bin, into your brown bin. But if it's clean, you can put it into your recycling bin. Or if you have a compost pile in your garden, you know, in your back garden, you can put that as a dry material as well.
Okay, that's good. I'm getting that right then. For a second, I thought maybe I'd been doing the wrong thing. Tea bags, Mindy, these can be controversial because some of them have elements of plastic, don't they?
Yeah, yeah, and I've spoken to the composting facilities, and they say they can take the tea bags, but the plastic will be filtered. They have a screening system, so the plastic can be collected. That I know, Lions now has a biodegradable tea bag. If you could try loose tea, that would be even better, and then you can put that in your back compost pile as well.
Okay, and then filter coffee as well into the compost pile or on top of plants.
Yes.
Right, because it's good for them. Old hot water bottles. I don't even need to ask you that. That's
rubbish bin.
Rubbish bin. The netting that fruit comes in.
Avoid it.
Okay. It's difficult, though. I was in the supermarket the other day and practically everything in the fresh fruit and veg was in plastic.
And that's the frustrating thing. And we've had discussions with the supermarkets. Can you please put out more things loose? A net of lemons, it doesn't protect the lemons at all. It just makes you buy more. Same with a net of onions or a bag of apples. Try to buy loose where possible. Also, put pressure on your supermarket saying, we don't want this.
Yeah, and I notice now as well, some supermarkets are selling rolls of compostable bags in the fruit and veg, but the ones that are free are the non-recyclable ones.
I know are they selling those now? I know Supervalue is putting out compostable bags. for your fruit and veg and what happens.
I don't know about the individual supermarkets, yeah. but I definitely saw them for sale in a fruit and veg section in one supermarket. Just on the soft plastic, it's just to be clear, it's not currently recyclable, is it?
Right, because what happened is the soft plastic mucked up the system because it was blowing all over the place. Also, they had different layers, and optical scanners were not sophisticated enough to tell between the different polymers.
Okay.
However, I think they've improved the optical scanners, and I think there's efforts afoot to put them back into the recycling bin, but that has not been the case yet. So right now, soft plastics do not belong in your bin.
Unexpected advice in the bagging area. Mindy O'Brien from Voice Ireland on Today with Clare Byrne. There's an unquestionable crisis in mental health in the country, exacerbated by the pandemic. And on Today with Clare Byrne, the numbers made for shocking listening.
Almost 6,000 people nationwide are waiting over a year to see a psychologist. The majority are children, with a further 2,600 youths waiting for an appointment at a child and adolescent mental health service. Now, the growing waiting lists come with mental health services struggling to cope with the demands of the pandemic. And you may remember how earlier this week we heard of a standoff at the Central Mental Hospital, staff there refusing to admit an extremely mentally ill man due to lack of beds. Our reporter Barry Lenehan is here. Barry, you've been speaking to lots of different people in this area. What have they been telling you about the demand, firstly, for services?
And figures last month from the Central Statistics Office show how around 6 in 10 people feel their mental health has suffered significantly during the pandemic. And mental health charities and those who provide free counselling and support tell me of a significant spike in demand for their services, especially since the second lockdown in October. Samaritans says its volunteers have listened for almost 73,000 hours since lockdown one last March, as thousands contacted its helpline. Aware recorded a 36% rise in calls in 2020. Alone notes an increase in a wide range of mental health impacts among older people, while the youth site Spun Out, it received 5,000 texts a month for each of the last 6 months from people aged 16 to 34 with issues including anxiety, depression and suicidal thoughts. And BodyWise, it's the national voluntary group supporting people with eating disorders, and it reports a 150% increase in people accessing its online support services in January and February of this year when compared to the same 2 months last.
It's an extraordinary increase there. And what about the GPs? What are they saying?
Around 90% of those, remember, with emotional or psychological problems can be treated by their GP without the need for referral to secondary services. But Dr. Dara Hume, she's a GP at the Drumalee Family Practice in Cavan Town, and within the past month alone, she's noticed an increase in those presenting with mental health symptoms.
Typically seeing 3 to 4 new, what I would call mental health consultations per week, and that's new cases per week. Now, obviously, we would have a lot of review cases as well. I think the commonest age group I'm seeing would be adolescents and 20s, I think are probably the commonest age group. But I'm also seeing quite a few healthcare workers as well. I would have quite a large cohort of patients, both in the public and the private sector, who are really struggling at the moment and probably afraid to stop in case if they get off the treadmill, they may not be able to get back on again, you know. So I think, look, Barry, I think everyone's mental health is under strain at the moment.
And is it since October and perhaps the second lockdown that this spike in mental health referrals has particularly become evident?
Absolutely, yes. And I feel it is on the increase, and it's particularly in the younger age group, which is quite worrying. The phrase I'm being told is I'm having problems with my mental health, which would never have been a phrase I would have heard before. People would have said I'm in bad form or I'm out of sorts or I'm not doing very well. So people are much more aware of their mental health, and I think that's a really positive sign. Certainly adolescents, they're missing out on their friends, they're missing out on sporting activities, they're missing out on maybe boxing, dancing, various music classes, things they would have normally done. And certainly I think people in their 20s, they're missing out on college. A lot of people have moved back home, maybe from Dublin or from the cities, back to living at home. And I think obviously isolation is the biggest issue, but then maybe not having people to share their negative thoughts with. Certainly I would always encourage everybody, talk to somebody. If you can get negative thoughts out of your head, then they don't go into your heart. 90% of cases I feel we deal with in general practice. Very few patients we actually have to refer onwards, to be perfect. perfectly honest with you, we can manage most cases in general practice.
And other GPs are seeing these trends as well, are they?
From discussing with my colleagues, absolutely, yes. There's no question. Mental health issues are very much to the fore. And as I say, in frontline workers as well, that's a worrying thing for the future.
That's Dr. Dara Hume there, the GP, Barry. Now, she said most cases are dealt with by GPs, but there will be some people who need to be referred on. And what's the experience then of those who need referrals?
Well, waiting times for those were bad before lockdowns and COVID were even worse. But now, according to the latest available figures, as provided to Sinn Féin's Matt Carthy and its mental health spokesperson, Mark Ward, 11,518 people across Ireland are waiting to see a public health psychologist. Almost 6,000 of those are waiting more than a year for an appointment from the HSE, and the majority are children. In Monaghan, the wait is longer still. According to a letter sent to GPs in the county, it says that we wish to advise that the current waiting time for primary care clinical psychology appointments is in excess of 75 weeks.
That's okay.
So that's more than a year. There are 296 psychologists working in primary care across Ireland, but the Psychological Society of Ireland, it says actually 276 more are needed to clear the current backlog.
So then specifically you mentioned children and teenagers. What is the picture when it comes to services for that age group?
So let's take Jigsaw, the mental health charity funded by the HSE, therapeutic support for young people suffering from depression and anxiety. The average waiting time to see a clinician there in 2019 was 8 weeks. This jumped to 12 weeks in 2020. Jigsaw Services in Cork reported average waiting times of 26 weeks last week, with Fingal 20 weeks. The current time waiting time nationally at the moment is 6 weeks. Child and Adolescent Mental Health Services, the waiting lists for those or CAMHS, they rose by 20% in 2020, with a 25% rise in children waiting more than 12 months for an appointment. The latest figures to the end of January show there are 2,613 youths waiting for access to CAMHS, with a third of those waiting at least 6 months. 283 children with moderate to severe mental issues are waiting more than a year for a first appointment with CAMHS.
So those delays, those waiting lists, Barry, they have to be having an impact.
Those working in paediatric hospitals say more and more children with psychiatric issues are presenting to emergency departments since the onset of the pandemic. One paediatric specialist registrar told me how he feels children are left on the CAMHS waiting list until, quote, they tip over the scale. And they're also presenting in emergency departments due to a dearth of beds for inpatient paediatric psychiatry. Presentations for eating disorders are also rising. At Crumlin's Children Hospital, they quadrupled in 2020 compared to 2019. And this is one of the recent trends identified by consultant paediatric psychiatrist Dr. Kieran Moore.
Those who have mental illness, which would be things like depression and more severe things like psychosis, but also within that then people who are suicidal or are self-harming. And then a larger cohort of children who would say have autism, who are presenting with difficulties that they're not able to deal with themselves. We're seeing, say, in the paediatric hospitals, really significant increase in children with eating disorders ranging from anorexia nervosa to bulimia nervosa.
Are A&E is equipped to deal with this rise in presentations from children with mental illness?
No, quite frankly, they're not. There's fantastic work that goes on there, and the doctors and nurses and primarily do fantastic work, but they're not trained in mental health or psychiatry. And there really is no out of hours service whatsoever in the country outside A&E's. And I know this is something that's been mentioned before. It's the last place you want a child to be attending to. When lockdown does eventually actually officially disappear, we can only presume that the need is going to increase. It's a real serious public health problem.
Speaking to those working in paediatric hospitals, they're saying not just acute psychiatric issues coming to them in A&E, but also children with abdominal pains or headaches, and that could be put down to anxiety as well, a rise in those sorts of presentations.
It's a human way of communicating, particularly for children, that is not easy. easy to put into words what is affecting us, and sometimes people don't know and we feel it in our stomach. And I suppose this is nobody's fault, but the ongoing ennui or lack of certainty associated with COVID-19 is adding hugely to that. So you've got children and adults who are pretty much stuck at home with, as I said, very little exit point or understanding about an exit point. And when they get stressed, they're unable to communicate it, and it's felt in their stomach, and that they present to A&E. And again, people are examined and get the treatment they need. But in terms of following up somebody whose primary presentation is actually anxiety, it's slow, it's poor, and the pathway for treatment can be unclear at best at times, and waiting lists are extremely long.
That's Dr. Kieran Moore. And you've been speaking to somebody who suffered from mental illness in the past, Barry. What have they been saying to you about the lockdown and the delays?
Jen Ronan has had issues with mental health since she was a child and currently volunteers for Haven Hub, a group that patrols Limerick's rivers at night. She's been telling me how many people are struggling in lockdown, especially for lack of access to a dedicated therapist or consultant psychiatrist. In 2013, Jen felt suicidal and with nowhere else to go, ended up in A&E. She says this isn't the place for those with mental health problems.
I said, my place is not here. I don't belong in A&E. I have an emergency, but it's not a physical emergency. I'm taking up a space that should be for a physical trauma. My crisis is mental. It's a mental health crisis. But eventually I got seen by a crisis nurse. It was all very kind of anticlimactic, very meh, very humdrum. Kind of felt like I was kind of being brushed off a little bit. It was sort of, I vaguely remember this crisis nurse sitting across from me and sort of, it looked like he was just rattling off a few phrases like, well, like I said, now you've everything to live for and you're a great girl. I was looking at him going, that's not curing me. Like, this is not helping. And I was sent home with the referral for Willowdale, which is a day clinic in Raheem. 3 months later, I think I eventually got into it.
A 3 month lag from when you presented in A&E saying you were suicidal until you got the help that you needed.
Just in again, and you're telling your story over and over again to a different face. And if that doesn't like trigger you every single time, then, you know, you're a very stronger person than me, because, you know, not only do you have to suffer the thing, but you have to relive the bloody thing by telling it over and over again to people who are not the same person you spoke to the time before. It's just the way the system is. There's not enough of people for you to see the same person. And that was one of the things that kind of caught me as well. I found it very frustrating.
I know you like your movies and film and so on. And there was, I suppose, what you would call a funny story now, the death by suicide of an actor impacted on you.
Well, it was Robin Williams. And when the story broke that Robin Williams had passed away, it just hit me like a sledgehammer. Maybe I was feeling a bit more vulnerable than normal, but I just couldn't get up from it. It was like losing a relative. So I said, okay, I need to go back in. So I dragged myself off to Willowdale again and saw a completely new person who came in, and she was a lovely girl, but she was very young. I had to tell her the whole sorry story again, and I was like, this is great. And so she sat and listened, and I said, well, the reason I'm here today is because, I said, this is going to sound very weird, but when Robin Williams killed himself, I said, been very upset since I've heard the news, and I don't really know what to do, and I feel very silly talking about it. And I sort of sat there, and she nodded quite sagely, and she said, oh, and were you very close to this Robbie Williams? And I just sat there and went, oh, I'm being punked, aren't I? Thank God I was able to laugh at it. And I just thought, yeah.
Looking at the system overall and your interaction with it, what's needed? Is it just a matter of resources?
I honestly don't know. I mean, if we'd a magic wand, we'd have, you know, extra billions of euro and build buildings and build a mental health A&E, which would be great, which would be a physical space for people to go if they're not feeling safe. At the moment, we're having to rely on volunteer organisations, people who literally walk the streets at night and during the day even now, because things are so bad with mental health. Lots of suicide prevention and intervention groups are in Limerick, and some of them have had to start going out in the daytime, which they have never had to do previously. It would be great if the government could just, I don't know, get its act together. You know, we don't know where we stand, and that's part of the problem with people. We're unsure, and people with mental health issues need some kind of surety or assurance that things are going to be okay.
And are you finding it difficult over the last 12 months or so?
Yeah, well, I live on my own, you see, so I have to be very careful of my mental health. Now I have a boyfriend and he's an absolute saint. Like, my spirit is almost broken at this point, and I'm normally a very strong person, and I'm just waiting for them to just say, oh, it's just going to be another year. And I just don't know what people are going to do. I don't buy newspapers. I don't read the news, because it's just heart scalding. You know, and if I'm not great and I'd be fairly strong and speaking up about things, I wonder how other people are doing. It feels like you're in a war zone. It feels like you're down in the bunker and you're literally just going shot by shot. You know, you're a bit of news do I have to deal with now.
Jen Ronan in Limerick, and the Department of Health and the HSE say they're finalising an initiative so children waiting more than 12 months for psychology services will be seen this year. And this is part of an unprecedented €1 billion budget for mental health in 2021 to meet those growing demands.
Barry Lenihan reporting on Today with Claire Byrne. And for helpline and support info for anyone affected by these issues, you can head over to rte.ie/support. Callers to Liveline yesterday shared their close encounters and unexplained experiences, and clearly catching something in the ether. Joe heard more UFO sightings today. Stephen told us what he spotted in Longford earlier this year.
I spotted what the physicist said, there's no such thing as a UFO. But I can tell him there is, definitely, what I've seen anyway.
Okay, an unexplained or an unidentified flying object.
Unidentified object, yeah.
What did you see?
Now, to lead up to this, right, my daughter in Mullingar, with the lockdown, and I was wondering how she's going to get on, and my other daughters and all that, because everybody's keeping to themselves. So she rang up and said she got a telescope, a Bressler telescope. And I thought, isn't that fantastic?
In the lockdown, for a hobby?
Yeah.
Yeah, brilliant.
Yeah, of course,
brilliant.
I think it'd be a great thing for young people, so...
Brilliant.
I was always half interested in myself, but she... The fact that she rang up and said she's after getting one, I was over the moon with that. Because with my son, the two of them are looking out at the moon and said he could see this and that, and God, I was delighted for them, you know. That we might go down to Bear Observatory someday and have a look when it's open again. So with that in my head, a couple of nights after that, it was a beautiful pitch black night, dead still. I just had to go to back. Sometimes I have a cigar out the back, and as my relations would tell me, I love a cigar. And hard to get them now, nearly impossible. But anyway, I stood out the back, looking up at the stars.
All right.
And I could see the plough as clear as anything. Everything was right there. And all of a sudden, this orange object, now, the way I would describe it is, if you put your arms out and widen them out, we're about a metre in distance.
Okay.
Up in the sky, it was that kind of big. It was probably the size of a football field in relation to size, right? Pure orange. Now, the funny thing was, as I'm always watching the birds in the garden and that, I bought myself a nice pair of binoculars. Myself and my brother, and go walking with the binoculars and that. So I said, isn't it great to have my binoculars here in the kitchen?
Okay.
I ran in to get them. I could see the thing, so to speak, clear, but I couldn't. It was a hazy thing going all across the whole side of it that I couldn't make out anything except this orange cigar-shaped object.
So you're now looking through your binoculars.
I could see it without the binoculars. But
okay.
I thought it was that big. Yeah, I thought I could see things in it, whatever they are in it. But it was haze out like you'd see in a film where they haze out people's faces. The other way would be glittery. You couldn't make out distinction. So that was going up whole length of the craft, and it was that big. And the funny thing, I said, God, isn't that amazing? It's right at my back door.
Yeah.
Looking out, I'm looking out across the field now where I am. I'm up in Longford, where the rugby club is, and there's a whole open area, nothing blocking me to see.
And
right
what
out.
Was your were you frightened or amazed?
No, I wasn't afraid, frightened.
Yeah,
I was amazed that it was part of it. I was amazed that it was at my back garden.
Okay.
The only thing, I am annoyed because I had a big phone upstairs, but because I thought the binoculars was going to show me everything I wanted to see, I was so mesmerised without looking at it. But I wasn't a bit afraid. I had seen one before, 40 years ago.
But you didn't take
a
photograph?
No, I couldn't. But if I know the
And what do you think was there. What do you think was in it, Stephen?
I don't know. There was somebody flying it, because what happened was it moved from left to right as I was looking at it, and it stopped completely opposite where I was.
A drone?
Up in the sky. No, it wasn't a drone, no, sure. No, I often had a little drone.
Okay.
I'm used to spotting planes in Abishul and watching for Cessnas 152s coming over.
Part of the country, yeah.
And you'd hear the sound of them, and 172. I flew 152.
And there was no sound?
No, completely no sound. And a helicopter you'd hear from miles away before it gets to you.
Of course you do, yeah.
But okay, it was pitch black, so nothing flies at night. Like that.
Okay, stay with us. Betty Mitchell is in Birmingham. Betty, what did you see?
Hi, Joe. In 1973-74,
right.
I'm not quite, I can't remember the date at the time, but I was visiting a friend in Birmingham, a and it's only about 5 miles from Birmingham Airport. And as I was leaving the house about 10:30 at night, you know, when you come out thinking, oh, it's a lovely night, looking up at the sky, and I said to my friend, oh, you know, it's a beautiful night, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden I just seen this red spot, like a, the end of a cigarette light coming out of the sky. And it came and it hovered right over the house where we were. Mm-hmm. And honestly, Joe, it was nearly sitting on the roof. It was a big black machine. Mm-hmm. It was hovering. There was no sound coming out of it. And both my friend and I, we were astonished. And with that, it shot off at such speed. And you just felt you were being observed. Anyway, shot across, and there was a field at the back of the house. We ran out to the back of the house. Nothing. Could see nothing, hear nothing. Just disappeared immediately. Anyway, a couple of days later, my friend, we were talking. So the next morning, when I came home, I rang Birmingham Observatory.
Yeah.
And I just asked them, you know, told them what happened. And I said, I was just wondering, has anybody else phoned in with any other experiences like this? So they said, no, not that we're aware of, you know. But they just asked me to give them the details, which I did, and left it at that. 2 days later, again talking to my friend, and he said, you know, I seen it again last night.
Okay.
I said, you're joking. No, no. I said, well, why didn't you, why don't you phone up the observatory and report it? And, oh, no, he said, people will only laugh at me.
Yeah.
And he was in a high position. He didn't want people laughing at him.
Do you think it's extraterrestrial life?
I don't know, Joe. All I can say, you know, Joe, we as human beings, we're not just human beings, we're spiritual beings as well.
Yeah.
And a few years later, and just reading when I was praying one day, and I just came across this reading, and I've heard it, I suppose, many times, but never paid any attention. Ephesians 6, verse 12 says, put on all the armor of God and the belt of truth around your waist, for it's not against human enemies that we have to struggle, but with the cosmic, wicked spiritual forces in the heavenly realms.
Well, that was unexpected. Caller Kevin responded to Betty's celestial suspicions.
There's a good bit of what she said now that I would be in agreement with. She was talking there about Jesus Christ, whom I'm a true believer in, and God the Father, myself. But she didn't say that about the evil spirits and about who guides the evil spirits, who's Satan, whom all of you seem to want to forget, but is truly there, present, as he was when he tempted Jesus for 40 days and 40 nights, which we're coming up to celebrating.
And what do you think of Betty telling the story of what she saw, and she did believe it was from some other planet or whatever? Some other place.
But you see, Joe, but just to say to you, when you see lights in the sky and you see things in the sky, you can't say that they are coming from another. Well, you can say it if you want. There's no one stopping you from saying it. But to believe that that's actually true. Now, Jesus Christ, our God the Father, didn't say that these, in chapter 6, 12, it didn't say that these were aliens that was coming from another planet and going to take us over. Now, because in the first instance, God put them there. He put them planets there. Right.
And is it compatible with being a Catholic, believing that there may be life out there?
No, personally, I don't think so, because you have to think of all these. You have to think of all these other things that's happening as Satan driven. No, you can see things.
Yeah, but
and things, evil things, and all that happen, and people, things can appear like they did all through the years, but guided by Satan. That's the thing. Not from another planet.
Yeah, but Kevin.
Go on, sorry.
Yeah.
Excuse me, Joe.
Well, first of all, Kevin, weren't you married to a Catholic, to a ministering Catholic priest?
To a Catholic priest, yeah.
And he was a Catholic priest till the day he died. And you were man and wife for many years. Do you mind
me asking? We were man and wife for 36 years. Now, Joe.
So there's a fair chance, Kevin, that Betty, who was married to a Catholic priest, knows a fair bit about religion. Do you accept that, Kevin?
You see, I would say she knows a fair bit about religion, but it's what the things, another word, one thing anyway for sure, being married to a Catholic priest doesn't give you any authority over anybody else as to how much you know about the script. You see, it's not the point of knowing the scriptures and that, or what's happening. You've got to believe it. No, you have to believe in God and Jesus Christ especially, or for that there's no way into heaven. And there's things happening out there and so many evil things and that going on. And of course,
excuse me,
Satan is the one. He's the only other power apart from Jesus, apart from Jesus Christ. Yeah. Okay. Betty wants to say something,
yeah,
I think, does
Betty,
she?
Yeah.
Excuse me, Joe.
Yes, Betty.
What I'm talking about is I do believe in the devil. I do believe in evil. I mean, you know what you were talking about all this week. Now, people are, how they come to the point of doing such dreadful things, if that's not evil, as I said before, I don't know what to say. Now, we are talking about, I don't know whether it was a real UFO, whether it was some cosmic power that in the heavenly realms, which the scripture talks about, and Jesus was full of the scripture. All I know is you said about the things Jesus did, also about the apparitions in different places all over the world, all these people. And, you know, Our Lady, when she appeared to Bernadette at Lourdes, she told Bernadette to go and tell the bishop. Bernadette went to the bishop and told him, and he didn't believe her. And what did Bernadette say? She said, Our Lady told me to tell you, not to convince you. You can't convince anybody whether God exists or not.
But
we,
Kevin,
talk about,
yeah, but
this, we talk Betty, about this dreadful world, Joe.
Betty, if I'm paraphrasing Kevin correctly, and correct me if I'm right, Kevin, or wrong. Kevin, what Kevin is saying is that this is, through no fault of your own, the sightings of these UFOs, it's the work of Satan. Is that fair, Kevin?
That's fair, yeah.
Okay.
Fair enough, yeah.
So are you saying Satan has channeled his...
Satan.
See,
there's highly intelligent men have been looking into it.
Yeah.
I am not saying it's Satan. I believe it was, in the end, when I read that reading, because it immediately brought to mind what I witnessed that night. I'd no account for it. I didn't see any human being. I didn't see any faces. I saw a big, black, heavy machine as big as a tank. And there was no windows. There was nothing.
Joe Duffy, handling those twists and turns like Lewis Hamilton on today's Lifeline. And that's all for today. Thanks for listening, and I'll be back tomorrow.